the court, please. My name's Joel Brett. I represent Lincoln County, Missouri. This is a Monell claim by the plaintiffs who were sexually assaulted by a sheriff's deputy who was working as a drug court tracker for the drug court. A portion of this case has already been before this court on a qualified immunity claim. When the Supreme Court decided Monell, when the Supreme Court decided the cases that followed Monell, and when this court decided cases under the Monell theory, it was generally stressed that this required a high and stringent standard. In order to impose liability on a municipality or local government, in order to avoid the Monell claims devolving into what would essentially be municipal liability for the criminal or intentional acts or tortious acts of an employee, because that alone is not sufficient to impose liability on the local government.
Let me alert that both counsel head on what I think this case boils down to in terms of a critical question, and that is under Canton versus Harris, when is there, quote, single incident liability for failure to supervise? Does there have to be a showing of a pattern of other unsupervised employees? Does it require a showing of a pattern of this employee's misconduct? Or does it require no pattern showing at all? And what case law would, none of the cases, you're all citing failure to train cases and then observations that the same legal principle should apply to failure to supervise, but that only frames the issue, that doesn't get to the heart of it.
So City of Ohio, Harris, the single incident cases, and these were failure to train cases, require what I think are three things. Either there has to be some sort of pattern of misconduct. So that changes where there's an incident and the policymaker knew that.
Except they say that Canton suggests there can be no pattern liability cases, and they give an example.
And that's in
that's why I included no pattern in my alternatives.
So that is a situation where there still has to be some obvious need, because that's the standard, I believe, deliberate indifference to an obvious need to supervise or train, and that deliberate indifference has to be because there is likelihood, a high predictable likelihood, that there's going to be a constitutional violation. So I think there has to be more under Canton, under the cases that follow, than this idea that if there's an injury, then the city is automatically liable, whether or not there was any knowledge by the policymaker.
Okay, if there has to be a pattern, what would constitute a pattern? One employee, one allegedly unsupervised employee screwing up many times, or does it require many employees doing the same misdeed?
So it could be one employee screwing up a number of times.
Okay.
That could be a possibility.
Okay, so here we have four plaintiffs and one employee, so we're heading toward a pattern, aren't we?
Well, except no one knew about the pattern. And there still has to be some knowledge, something obvious. It wasn't as though these sexual assaults occurred and then someone found out about it and then nothing was done. That's where I think the pattern issue comes in.
Well, what about this allegation that because nobody supervised him and everybody agrees he had no supervision, that had he just even been required to submit reports as to where he is to the people that he checked in on, because he was a checker, that was his title, wasn't it?
Tracker.
The people that he checked in on, several of the people said, everybody in the program knew that if you were a man and you were in it for 3 years, you'd maybe get visited twice, and if you're a woman, particularly an attractive woman, he'd be at your house four times a month. I mean, that's, is that turning a blind eye to something that's obvious to anybody who would have looked?
Well, there was no blind eye to turn because, and I apparently did a very poor job of it distinguishing this to the jury. That was handled separate and outside of the sheriff's department. This was the drug court, this panel of people. The tracker was part of that drug court team, no one ever told the sheriff.
I think that ship has sailed. I mean, I know you argued that the sheriff shouldn't have been the one supervising his own deputy, but I think you lost that argument. Well, now, unless you want to relitigate that issue.
I still believe that this...
I don't think you have to concede that.
Well, I still don't believe that the policymaker is charged with this exceptional task of knowing that there was a need for supervision or for training. I mean, the supervision and training are treated similarly. There's just very few supervision cases. And so when they're, at least for analysis purpose, they're treated similarly. But if you look at this from a practical standpoint, it's easy to look at failure to train because there was medical, the Canton case involved a lack of medical training, someone's injured or not treated, that's a problem. But the court still said, well, look, just because there was inadequate training or you think there was inadequate training, that doesn't necessarily mean that resulted in the injury. You know, people make mistakes, jailers make mistakes. And if you look at all these failure trains, the Brady, the Connick case where the prosecutors were not trained in Brady, these are all training and or supervision because I think they're linked together. I think when we, and I use the example, and I think the Canton case talked about this, not about tasers, but if you have new tasers and you give the tasers to some people, some police officers coming out of school, and you don't train them and you don't supervise them, and by supervision, and that's I think where there's a breakdown, and again, I'm not sure how this argument goes here, but does supervision mean that he's going to be followed around 24 hours a day to make sure he doesn't do anything to these drug court participants when the drug court sending this guy out in the first place? This might be the ship that sailed again, but the sheriff's department wasn't guiding this person to these women's houses. He was going on Thanksgiving. He was going on his day off. The sheriff's department was in charge of tracking the tracker. The drug court commission or the drug court was. So, but back to my taser example, if you're going to supervise, that means that someone with experience with this taser is going to supervise the person who's learning how to use the taser. It's part of the training. It just makes sense.
That's just not sure that's true in some cases. But there are some misdeeds that you shouldn't need train,
well,
but you might need to supervise.
Well,
and it strikes me that sexually assaulting your clients, to call for lack of a better word, would be an example of that. You shouldn't have to train a law enforcement officer of either gender not to sexually assault their people under their guidance or control.
And I think that
it doesn't take training; it might take supervision.
But that's Parrish versus Ball. That's this court's analysis of sexual assault, which was Parrish versus Ball and Andrews versus Fowler and the recent case of Doe versus Gay, where there was the court found that there's no presumption, no obvious need to supervise a law enforcement officer who knows the law, who's supposed to follow the law, to make sure that that person isn't sexually assaulting a person who he's stopped or who he's tracking. So those cases, but each of those cases talk about whether there was a pattern or not, whether there was knowledge by the policymaker about prior incidents. In fact, the Doe versus Gay case, which is very interesting, very recent, really, the court said, we don't care about what happened previously. But that still went to the training. In fact, that was less about training and supervision and more about a pattern of misconduct.
Now, you haven't challenged the jury instructions, right?
I didn't object to that particular jury instruction because I had filed two motions for summary judgment, the motion, a judgment on the law at the close of the plaintiff's case, and the judgment at the close, and a post-trial motion. And
the way to preserve an instruction error is not to file a summary judgment motion. You gotta fight that every step of the way, including in the instructions where the
We don't have
an instruction issue, so whatever was instructed.
I didn't object
was
to
the
instruction.
The
and I think the law of the case, prior to submitting the instruction on the judgment as a matter of law, was incorrect. That I thought the court, looking at this, that there was no evidence whatsoever that this policymaker, that there was an obvious risk, that there was something that he knew about that would have caused him to impose some sort of supervision. And the other reality is, let's say he knew there was a risk. Let's say one of the plaintiffs came forward and said, Sheriff, I'm being sexually assaulted. Well, he's going to do presumably exactly what he did in this case. It's not going to be, okay, well, you did this, we're going to place more supervision on you now. That's not the remedy. And I think that's what the courts have consistently said is, you have to specify what it is that you want. If it's inadequate training, you have to say, what is the lack of training? What was the lack of training in the Brady case?
Well, but supervision can not only be after the fact remedy, but what I think the argument here is that had he been supervised and knew somebody was looking over his shoulder, whether it was having a second person accompany him on these home visits to female offenders, whether it was spot checks or something like that, that maybe he wouldn't have been as aggressive in assaulting these women had he known somebody was actually looking at the reports that said he was visiting women's homes five times a month and he's visiting male offenders once a year. Had he known that was being done, maybe he wouldn't have assaulted them in the first place.
But isn't that the speculation that we want to avoid? That
but isn't that what a jury decides on the jury? You asked for a jury instruction on that, and they gave a jury instruction on that issue, and the jury found against you.
They did.
I mean, I guess it really comes down to should it ever have gone to the jury in the first place?
And that's my argument. And my contention still is that even though it's an objective standard, there has to be some notification, some reason. It's a high standard. The policymaker would have had to have known that there was a high predictability, a high probability of this person sexually assaulting these women. And the fact is that the drug court that was supervising the tracker, again, that's the other argument, was actually placing the tracker, had some notice that there were some problems, and had nothing, wasn't associated with the county sheriff's department or the county. So, again, that argument fell on deaf ears with the jury. But and the other part is, this has to be the motivating factor. I think that's the other connection. That's the other part of this difficult standard is when there's a sexual assault, and if you look at each of those sexual assault cases, even though, again, they're not supervision cases, but there has to be some connection between this person who's a sexual predator and the fact that he's not trained or supervised. And I don't think there is a causal link here. He was going to do this some way or another because he was. He had meetings.
It seems to me
clearly a sufficiency argument.
But it seems to me the argument comes down to, if you assume the sheriff should have been the one supervising him and didn't, that were there enough red flags out there that had he been exercising his supervisory responsibility, that he could have connected the dots. Some people in the drug court knew some things. People in the jail knew that he was taking female offenders outside for smoke breaks and things that were clearly violating jail regulations. There were a lot of different things a lot of different people knew, none of which the sheriff admittedly knew. But had he been supervising and asked, could he have connected the dots? Is he required to do that?
I think when the drug court knew the cigarette breaks, I think that unless he was doing something that would have indicated to someone, and again, two judges, a drug court team, a psychologist, probation, they all knew that there was some goofy things that he was doing, but they weren't sexual assault. It wasn't a violent crime. He didn't have a propensity for violent or being predatory. So that, in my opinion, holding the county responsible for this sexual predator doesn't fit in with the previous cases. Thank you.
Was the jury instructed that the sheriff had a duty to supervise Edmund?
No. The wording was, and again, we cobbled this together with counsel. The instruction was that...
I don't care what instruction said.
The instruction said that I think that he had to believe that the jury had to believe that the sheriff was the supervisor.
And you argued that he was not.
Right. Not only that, but that he had nothing to do with making sure, had any knowledge that this guy was going to these houses late at night or on Thanksgiving or any of those other times.
So, but I just, that's when I use the phrase the ship has sailed, I want to make sure, I don't mean to be flippant, but as I understood the state of the record is, you argued he was not the supervisor, it was the drug court judges. Drug court judges said no, it was the sheriff. And that issue was submitted to the jury, and the jury made a finding it was the sheriff.
Yes.
May it please the court, my name is Beavis Schock. I represent SM, KW, LM, and KS. What I'd like to do is first address the issue that was discussed right at the end and just read you the first element of the jury instructions. It says, first, the Lincoln County Sheriff, as policymaker for Lincoln County, was responsible for supervising Scott Edwards as drug court tracker. So that was the very first element. Laid out very clearly, the jury had to find that to be true.
What did the instructions say about shared supervisory responsibility?
It said
nothing
except that the need for supervision was obvious, so that would get into the next element. It did not say that there were others responsible.
And instruction
I would say it was contrary to our law of the case, but that's water over the dam. Since the issue is not preserved.
Your Honor, may I address
The whole point of the Creek Bomb decision was that the multi-agency sharing of responsibilities was the key to this problem. So here we have jury instructions that ignore it. But lawyers are entitled to try the case they want to try.
Your Honor, may I address the question that you asked my opponent first, which is what is the requirement? I think the three ones you described were a pattern of other employees, a pattern of one employee, and no pattern at all. So I'd address the Canton case, which does have language in it of specific events over time. So it talks about the plural. Therefore, I believe that there does have to be a series of events in order to get liability. Just one event is no good. And as my opponent, I think, correctly said, the Parrish case is just one event. What I'd like to do is talk just for a moment about the events that were before the jury that can provide that information. And I think the...
But there also has to be, the decision maker has to know.
So I think there's two ways to look at that. The word obvious says that there should be constructive notice. If he did know it, then we would have kept Mr. Kriegbaum in personally. As it was, Kriegbaum was out because we can't prove he knew anything. But I would like to suggest to the court that in the facts, there are things that he did do or knew that, and I say he, I'm talking about Scott Edwards, and there are things that the sheriff didn't do. But let me address the four things that Edwards did do that we proved that get us to the constructive notice of obvious. And we've talked about most of them already. Obviously, the giving of all the time to the ladies, the
And who
smoke.
Knew, and who knew that? And how should he? Who knew that? And how should Krigbaum have been constructively knowledgeable of that?
Well, so who knew that is the gentleman. I can't remember Griffin. He said everybody knew.
It was Griffin again?
Griffin was one of the participants in the drug court.
So he's client.
He actually was a man. He described himself as the golden boy of drug court. He was the guy who actually got well and got better and followed all the rules. And he said everybody knew. Now
he was a rehab defendant.
Yes.
Yeah, he was not an employee.
Correct. Can I just address this sort of interesting logical issue that your question comes to, Judge Malloy, which is how do we get to constructive? Well, that's really the way the issue of obvious is structured logically. If it's obvious but the person doesn't know and there can be liability, then what the plaintiff must show is sort of a circle of facts known by lots of people. And so if the sheriff had looked, he would have known. In other words, I think the case law rejects the bury your head in the sand defense for the government entity. It works for the individual liability, and that's why we lost up in this court 2 years ago. But when there is this, if we're going to have the obviousness standard, which is well established in the law, then sort of by definition, you bring in facts that were taking place and you say, hey, these facts should have come out. So if I can just look at four of them. We've talked about the smoke breaks. I note that Mr. Krigbaum, the sheriff, said that his white shirts knew and they should have told him. So that's important. His senior people knew. This is admitted in the record discussed in the brief. They knew. They didn't do anything about the smoke breaks. And he said, I guess rightly, that's pretty serious. When somebody's sentenced to jail and they're taken outside the jail for smoking for McDonald's, that is a serious matter. I mean, being in jail is being in jail. Another one, though, is that Mr. Edwards, the perpetrator of all this, put SM in a hotel without any authority. And one of the drug court judges, Commissioner then Sullivan, said, he sort of shook his head on the stand, and this is right in the record, he says, I don't know how possibly Edwards could have done that. He had no authority to do that. That's a terrible thing. He took SM out of her mother's home and put her in this hotel. I don't wish to use offensive language, but Mr. Edwards said to employees, now this is different than the sort of everybody knew, which came from a participant, Mr. Griffin. This is in what they called staffing. So they'd have meetings before court and say, how's so-and-so doing? How's so-and-so doing? And Edwards stated,
this is drug court staff.
This is drug court staff. Before they actually get into court, they would have a private meeting.
Krigbaum's not there. Just
correct, absolutely. If Krigbaum had been there, I think we would have kept him in the first round. But he used these offensive statements. A stiff penis would help her, the hot dog in the mayonnaise jar. Now, I can tell you as a practicing attorney, as a regular common sense human being, that there is a line in a professional environment. I mean, somebody might say that in a fraternity house, but in a professional environment, statements of that nature are so far beyond the line that it, I think, meets the standard of obviousness.
Well, let's focus on deliberate indifference. Where is your failure to supervise case? I know you only cite failure to train cases, and Levy just said the standard was the same. Atkinson and Robinette denied supervisor liability. What's your favorite failure to supervise deliberate indifference case?
I think that Harris versus Pagedale is one. There we have a series of prior sexual incidents, and that one, the liability was found, Your Honor. That's my favorite.
I don't see it quickly in your brief. Yeah. Table of authorities.
if I cited it in my brief. I might have seen it in prep for oral argument, sir. It's not cited in my brief, Your Honor. I can send a letter with the exact citation.
Please give us a 28-J letter.
I will do that, sir.
And then seems to me the a problem I have with this case is that even if the evidence was sufficient to show that Edmonds should have been obvious, Edmonds needed supervision. Isn't the question whether it was obvious that there was need for additional supervision by the sheriff's department?
And I have the answer to that one, I think. Your Honor, let me draw your attention to a colloquy that I had with Sheriff Kriegbaum on the stand, and this is at page 48. If I can read it, it's only about 20, 30 words.
48 of what?
Of my brief, sir. Red brief. Do you agree there's a risk when law enforcement are alone with females? Yes, sir. Do you think it's an obvious risk? I would think so. Yes. Do you agree a person who has tremendous power over other people needs to be supervised? Yes. And there is this, at the trial we developed this power disparity analysis. In the 30 years you spend in law enforcement, you observe that sometimes commit misconduct. I think we're missing a person. Officers commit misconduct. Well, yes, I did. And also sexual misconduct. Is that right? Now, yes, sir. So he admitted on the stand that it was obvious and that the precise kind of...
Well, I said that. I mean, that's you talk about he disciplined his chief deputy, who in under that line of that chain of command misbehaved. But Edmonds wasn't in his direct chain of commands during the time he was on the drug, acting for the drug court. So I think the evidence is, at least it was before, that Kriegbaum ignored the drug court, basically.
Yes.
With the assumption, everybody assumed the drug court was doing its job. And so where was the terrifically obvious, where was it terrifically obvious to a sheriff whose employee was, moonlighting isn't quite the right word, but who had a second role in which the sheriff was not the immediate principal supervisor. Where's the need for additional supervision? Why does the sheriff have to assume that the drug court isn't providing the supervision that was needed for drug court tasks?
And I think I can answer that, Your Honor. It's because he agreed to do it. Well, his predecessor agreed to do it, binding his agency.
You mean the MOU paragraph 7?
Yes, sir.
Which he didn't know.
Okay, so that's interesting.
Yeah,
we agree with that. Right. It was startling at the deposition when we showed it to him, and he said, first time I've seen that. But this goes to the bury your head in the sand defense. The bury your head in the sand defense is rejected for the government. The Kriegbaum can get out of it personally by saying, gee, I paid no attention. But if he had a duty to do that under a signed document, didn't he have the job at the beginning of his term to say, I've been elected, I'm taking over this position, now I have to find out what I have to do? He has to do that. He has to know what his job is, and if he doesn't, it does fall, I think, the responsibility falls on the county through his inaction. In other words...
Okay. I think that's clearly... I don't know if it's your best answer. It's clearly an answer. It seems to me that if there was no sovereign immunity in play here, all of these institutions would have been Monell defendants. And I wonder how the case would have played out. Everyone else was immune, so you managed to get a jury instruction in which the other institutions with some responsibility weren't in play. But I'm not sure that's enough that gets you around the deliberate indifference problem.
Well, as I read deliberate indifference,
the strict standard.
Yes, and I'll read you what I think the standard is in the case law. It's conscious or reckless disregard for the consequences of one's actions. Now, let me note that that is defined right in the jury instruction at the bottom. So we told the jury what the test was. And, of course, there are many cases where, other cases that say, we assume the jury can do its job. The jury is able to follow the instructions.
Okay. Just reading that doesn't put conical for me.
But what I guess
it's
I would...
failure to train and supervise standard, which is more specific than the, you know, the vague generality definition of deliberate indifference.
Well, and of course, the Farmer versus Brennan case talks about kind of a continuum. You have negligence, you have willful conduct, and somewhere in the middle is deliberate indifference. I keep coming back to the fact that to not make an inquiry about what one's job is as a government official, that is deliberate indifference. To me, it meets the standard. It's what we argued, and I think the jury found it.
Well, sure, but it doesn't meet the standard of what's so obvious that constitutional violations are going to result because of my inaction.
Okay, and if I can answer that. My answer to that is that there is supposed to be some kind of a nexus between the kind of constitutional violation and the circumstances of the case. And that's where I come back to the facts I mentioned earlier. The obscenities he mentioned, the fact that everybody knew that he was paying all the attention to the ladies, the smoke breaks, that these factors, so there's a word sometimes used in the criminal law called grooming, which is when a perpetrator of a crime sort of grooms the victim for what's going to happen. And I would suggest that these smoke breaks meet that test exactly. Those are very, very serious matters. Because they are, in other words, the taking them out for the smoke break is a grooming indicator. Just like, the hotel is the biggest one of all. Putting a lady in a hotel, I mean, it's pretty hard to justify that.
But that was a drug tracker time.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That was a drug court time.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Jail, not necessarily.
I'm sorry?
The smoke breaks, not necessarily. I don't know.
Yes, I'd agree with that, Your Honor. That's the end of my time, and I'm so appreciative of your taking time to converse today about this case with me, and I'm honored to present it on behalf of my clients.
Thank you. Mr. Brett, have some time?
No, Your Honor.
I'll give you a couple minutes if you'd like.
Again, if we look at the sexual assault cases, although they're primarily failure to train cases, those cases, even when there's some hints of some wrongdoing that was in front of the chief of police in Parrish versus Ball or Andrews versus Fowler, even when there were incidents of prior sexual misconduct that's not as severe, the court still ruled that there must be some obvious need to train or, again, I'm using them interchangeably, even though there's nothing that says they're interchangeable, the need to supervise. And those cases, in fact, there was one case, and I think that was Fowler, where the court gave summary judgment to the municipality and then held the chief in and said, you know, the chief's responsible because he knew about these prior incidents. And in this case, these were drug court participants who were treated slightly different. They were in jail, but they were still part of the drug court. He was their tracker. He knew them. What indication is there to anyone, the sheriff, other white shirts, the drug court team, the drug court commissioners, that he was going to sexually assault or was maybe then sexually assaulting these women? There has to be more than just a hint, I believe, and this grooming is, I think that's far away from what's going on in this case. I mean, I think this guy was a sexual predator, and he was going to take advantage of his position, whether he had a clock in or out or had an answer. He was answering to the drug court. The drug court administrator, Heather Graham, testified that he turned in pieces of paper indicating what he had found and that he was doing the drug court tracking, and none of that was shared with the sheriff. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case has been well briefed and argued. Interesting issues, and we